Well, good morning, everyone, and it's good to be with you once more. The subject of humanism might seem to be a strange one to talk about in terms of a Bible topic, but I think it's an important one. It is, I suppose, in many ways, the prevailing belief system in this country and much of the Western world today. And I hope to be able to show you, just in outline, that it's not new, and that we do find evidence of the ideas of humanism in the Bible. The word humanism was only coined in the 19th century, but it really covers a way of looking at life, which goes back to Greek times. And that's why we took our introductory reading from Acts chapter 17, when Paul was visiting the city of Athens, the centre of the Greek world. Today, we apply this word humanism to an approach to understanding and explaining life, which is based on rationality and on logic. It looks for a scientific explanation for everything, and it excludes, it doesn't actually allow the possibility of a greater intelligence, of a God, that is excluded from humanist reasoning. But most of the ideas, if not the modern scientific explanations, actually owe their origins to Greek times and to the various Greek schools of philosophy. We'll know of most of them, even if we don't know what they taught. And we'll have come across some of them in the scriptures. And in fact, in our introductory reading, we read of two, didn't we? The Epicureans and the Stoics. Two more we want to bear in mind are Plato and Aristotle, but we're not going to go into any detail. When we find ourselves wrestling with humanist arguments today, and we're looking on the slide at an example of a bus advertising campaign which took place 3 or 4 years ago across the country. And you might remember that advertising slogan was put on the sides of buses: "There is probably no God, so stop worrying and enjoy your life." And that campaign was run by the British Humanist Association. Well, it might be worth bearing in mind that Paul and other first century apostles would have wrestled with very similar arguments in their day as they travelled around the Greek and the Roman world. I'd like you to come with me, if you would, to a New Testament passage, the first letter to the Corinthians and chapter 15. There's a really familiar verse here in this 15th chapter, verse 32, where Paul says, "If after the manner of men I have fought with beasts at Ephesus, what advantage is it me?" And this is the familiar bit, isn't it? "If the dead rise not, let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we die." Well, if we just compare what Paul said there with the advertising on the buses, we'll find actually that it was the same argument. Different words, but exactly the same argument. So on the buses we read, "There is probably no God," and Paul says, "If the dead rise not," in other words, if there is no hope in the future, the buses said, "Now stop worrying," and Paul said, "Let us eat and drink," and the buses said, "And enjoy your life," and Paul says, "For tomorrow we die." So the sentiment is exactly the same. There it was 2,000 years ago, as Paul wrote to the church in Corinth, and the Humanist Association picks up the same idea and puts it across buses across the length and breadth of Britain, I think without realising that they were picking up a Bible idea. And what Paul actually was doing was using an illustration of that way of thinking which was prevalent in the Greek world 2,000 years ago, using that to put across his points. So, in an introductory reading, back to Acts chapter 17, if you don't mind coming with me. We started off in verse 18. And there, Paul is in Athens, and we read straight away that certain philosophers of the Epicureans and of the Stoics encountered him and started to debate with him. So there we are introduced immediately to two of the main groups of philosophy in Athens at the time. Now, the Stoics, there's a little picture of how Athens might have looked at the time of Paul, and you'll see that there were little areas around the city where the different schools of philosophy were centred, and the philosophers, depending on what their ideas were, what their understanding was, would congregate in one of those centres and spend their days debating philosophical things. And so this is what Paul would have encountered as he visited Athens and tried to bring the teaching of Christ to the Athenians. And he mentions straight away the Stoics and the Epicureans. Now, the Stoics followed the teaching of a man called Zeno, and he taught from a porch by the marketplace in the centre of Athens. And a porch was called a stoa, so that's why the Stoics acquired their name of Stoics, the people that met at the stoa in the marketplace. Their philosophy was very severe, that stiff upper lip kind of thinking. On the other hand, the Epicureans, who Paul mentions, followed a man called Epicurus. He taught on the edge of Athens in an area of gardens, and they had a very different philosophy. It was based on the principle that life was there to be enjoyed. Now, this wasn't a hedonistic way of life. They didn't shun work. They accepted civic responsibility. But they did argue that you only live once, and so you should make the most of it. Doesn't that sound familiar? It comes so close to the principles of humanism today. And so Paul's address, when he stood on Mars Hill at the very centre of Athens, just below the temple, Paul's address really gets into talking about this way of thinking and challenging it. And he defends the creative work of the Almighty. And we see from the reaction that he got in Athens that it attracted derision. These people were very much for the you only live once, so make the most of it and enjoy it way of life. And Paul was trying to take them in a different direction, one which they didn't want to go down. Now, I did say that humanism doesn't allow for the possibility of a God interfering in people's lives and trying to direct what they did. And you're going to say to me, I'm sure, that surely the Greeks and the Romans worshipped so many gods. And here it is in Acts chapter 17, they had a god for every purpose. And in fact, they were so worried that they might have missed one out and offended him, that Paul found an altar there in Athens, which was to the unknown god, that the one they might possibly have missed out. So how does that square with what we've been saying about modern humanism and about it being atheistic? Well, This is what one philosopher had to say, a man called Seneca, who was a Stoic, and he lived at the time of Paul. Religion is recognized by the common people as true, and there it was in Athens, altars and idols to gods everywhere. Recognized by the wise as false, and recognized by the rulers as useful. The time to live is now. So there we are. There again is the humanist way of looking at things, concluding his thoughts, but a very neat summing up. If the people want to believe in lots of different gods, then let them, that's fine. But those who are in the know that that's not right. And the people who rule them actually find it quite useful to have them following those different ideas. In reality, the Greek philosophers were dismissive of popular religion. They saw it as superstitious. There was no God for most of the learned. And they developed their own theories of where man had come from, a little bit like our modern theory of evolution. Well, other ancient cultures had also delivered similar lines of reasoning. I'm sure you can think of things like Confucianism in China, going back about 500 years before Christ. Buddhism in India, from about the same time. Both were codes of life which didn't allow for a god, but taught individual responsibility. There was a man in India about 700 years before Christ, wrote a lovely bit of verse, really. It's there, we're not going to spend any time on it. No heaven exists, no final liberation, no soul, no other world, no rites of caste. So we can see where he's going on that. And he ends up, just as the Greeks did, let a man borrow money from all his friends and feast on melted butter. So life is for living, let's get on with it and enjoy it. And it's all across the world. We can, of course, if we think about it, find Bible evidence for this sort of reasoning going right back to the beginning of time. Just think of the words of the serpent in the Garden of Eden. You will be as gods, knowing good and evil. That was the proposition to Eve and to Adam, and it was one which they found too tempting to resist. And so they were ready to throw in their lot with the serpent and dispense with the Creator. And in that sense, it's fascinating to learn that the British Humanist Association, one of whose vice presidents is a man called Richard Dawkins, actually endorses the Bible account, and again, possibly without realising it, because they say humanist ideas have probably been around as long as humans. Well, again, looking back to the Bible and following its account, we come to the time of Noah, and we find that people had adopted then a way of life which was centered on the enjoyment of life's pleasures and dismissed the idea that you needed to recognize and obey a creator. And after the flood, Genesis tells us that men started to build great cities, and foremost of these early developers was a man called Nimrod, the great hunter, the Bible says. And it also says he was mighty in the face of the Lord, in the face of God. He was a challenger, someone who was prepared to challenge the authority of God himself. And so man's wish to exclude God to be the dominant being in his own right, has continued right through to our present time, and we now witness in our world today probably the strongest challenge yet to the authority, even the existence of God. Now, I might surprise some of you, it certainly surprised me when I realised that there is one element of humanism for which we could have cause to be very grateful, because it was humanist teaching from Greek times, which we've just looked at so very briefly, this idea of looking at things logically and rationally, it was that idea, that way of looking at things, which inspired most of the Protestant reformers in the 15th and 16th centuries. That's strange, isn't it? That 500 years ago, these people appeared who did have a religious belief, but they actually took the idea of looking rationally and logically at things to challenge the teaching of the church, which they felt was corrupting God's word. And so it was that ideas from which humanism came were used to challenge and to set off the Protestant Reformation. The Roman Church, of course, had built a system of worship that was based on tradition and ritual. It had absorbed pagan beliefs from the nations into which the empire extended itself. It did that to make conversion to their form of Christianity more palatable and more easy. And it developed to the extent that the church calendar dictated every aspect of daily life. What you did this week and on this day and in this month was laid down by the challenge, by the calendar of the church. And non-observance was not an option. You had to conform, or at the very least, you were ostracized, if not punished far more severely. And in fact, the church ran a court system so that it could impose severe penalties on people. And it constantly threatened with the ideas of purgatory and hell unless steps were taken to reduce your liability. And those steps inevitably involved handing over money to the clergy. So, I can hear you saying, moving on, that was the world of Europe in the 15th century, at which those early reformers, adopting the ideas of the Roman and Greek world, challenged and risked their lives to question and challenge. So we have a little bit of a paradox. But humanism presents a direct challenge to the existence and to the power of God, and yet it was the same reasoning, the same logic, which actually challenged the church and allowed the Protestant movement to develop, and allowed us, ultimately, as Christadelphians, to be here today to put our own point of view and our own understanding of the scriptures to you. And that followed an interesting path which we haven't got time to go into, but from those reformers, a century later, came the Quakers, a group who discarded all ritual and all formal procedure in their worship, and who modern humanists actually recognise and see as forerunners of their own position. And then another 100 years later, we had what was called the Age of Enlightenment, when people like Thomas Paine published The Rights of Man and The Age of Reason. And his writings influenced the French Revolution. And he is quoted as having said, "My country is my world, my religion is to do good." And then in the 19th century, we had people like Charles Darwin and his work on the on evolution and his work, The Origin of Species. Darwin actually studied to become an Anglican clergyman. And although he came to regard himself as agnostic, he never actually denied the existence of God. But in spite of this, humanists claim him as one of theirs. So, if we now remind ourselves of the way that humanist thought has developed within a religious context for so long, it's probably not surprising to find there have been many humanist groups, some still around today, that do claim to be religious and do acknowledge the deity. But they put their emphasis on ethics and moral living rather than obeying God's commandments. And they're known as religious humanists. And we do see shades of this around us. The emphasis of many churches today is on doing good with little or no time for God's word. Many of those churches would have no great problem with most of the problems of humanism. They'd be prepared to applaud them and endorse them, but they wouldn't actually describe themselves as humanist. Well, we cannot accept humanism as it is practiced today. We place great store on understanding what God requires of us and on obeying his commands. This must direct our actions rather than any human reasoning about right and wrong. Obeying God's law does require us to live to the highest moral standards. It does require us to be compassionate in our dealings with one another and with those around us. But where our motivation comes from is vitally important. Whether it comes from our own reasoning or from our desire to be obedient to God's law is a vital distinction. So let's look just very briefly at humanism as practiced today. And before we do that, let's just pick up another modern word, secularism. Secularism and humanism are quite different from one another in their beliefs and aims, but it can be easy to confuse them. Secularism believes in the separation of the state from religion. It believes in equality for everyone and respect of belief for individuals. So it does not deny religion, it does not deny a God. But it believes that religion shouldn't get mixed up with government and people should be free to choose. Humanism supports secularism, but it denies the existence or a role for a God. So there's that quite important distinction to bear in mind. So, this is how the British Humanist Association defines humanists today. They are people who think for themselves about what is right and wrong, based on reason and respect for others. People who find meaning, beauty, and joy in the one life we have without an afterlife. People who look to science rather than religion as the way to discover and understand the world. People who believe that you can use empathy and compassion to make the world a better place for everyone. In this country, humanists are represented by the British Humanist Association. This is a national registered charity, and it has prominent personalities amongst its members, and it likes to present an image of itself as, if you like, the nice side of atheism. It is a powerful and influential campaigning body. We should be aware of that. It has ties to an influential group in Parliament. It has a campaigning arm. It also has a celebrant service. A celebrant service is effectively a network of pseudo-ministers who you can engage to perform weddings, to conduct funerals, to conduct naming ceremonies for your babies. It is a function for people who would like a service for the important steps in life, but not a religious one. And here are some of the issues on which the Humanist Association campaigns. It campaigns against faith schools, for a secular society, for human rights, to remove bishops from the House of Lords. It campaigns for gay marriage, and this weekend we've seen a notable success in that area, haven't we? For assisted dying, for the removal of funding for alternative medicines in the NHS, for animal welfare, including an end to kosher and halal slaughter. I think we would find ourselves at odds with at least half, possibly more, of those campaigning issues. But we could say that the campaigning group performs a sort of missionary or preaching function, and it is immensely influential through Parliament and with its access to the media. And then the celebrant service fills the gaps in the lives of non-believers by taking care of those significant moments when a religious ceremony might otherwise have been used. Many of you may have been to a humanist service. I certainly attended a humanist funeral 2 or 3 years ago. A service that was warm and comforting, but of course made no mention of God or of any future hope for the deceased. And some of the more prominent members of the Humanist Association promote their own ideology and dogma with a crusading zeal. I don't think I over-exaggerate that. A crusading zeal that might make the most fervent evangelist look half-hearted. And we've already mentioned one person, a present Vice President Richard Dawkins. This is taken off his website. And here he is quite shamelessly selling a range of merchandise which aims to ridicule and to decry religious beliefs. And, there was a fairly recent newspaper comment on his activities. Why Richard Dawkins reminds me of a religion. New atheists may repudiate faith, but their schismatic squabbles and adulation of figures such as Dawkins sound familiar. Well, some of the aims and ethics of humanism sound laudable. Its adherents want people to live responsibly and considerately while enjoying what life has to offer. One of the published values of the British Humanist Association is being cooperative, working with others of different beliefs for the common good. But sadly, the evidence is that it's not practiced like that. It doesn't work like that. So, just summing up, humanism is founded on the legacy left to us by the Greeks in particular of rational examination of the available evidence. It did such a lot to free Europe from the traditions and from the dogma of Catholicism, and it provided the challenging environment for Protestantism to develop. But sadly, the modern humanism that we see today, preached by its leaders and repeated endlessly by our media, finds no room for the possibility of a creative power, no room for a God with a purpose for mankind. And not only that, it increasingly seeks to silence or to ridicule those who do. This makes it a dangerous movement, one which takes us back to the very challenge to the authority of God, which was put forward in Eden and taken up by the first man and woman. And little has changed in all that time. Only the sophistication of the arguments which are put forward to justify the challenge. And there are elements here of the very bigotry which humanists seek to label people of faith. And so humanism is to be avoided. And we'll let our final word come from the scriptures. The psalmist, 3,000 years ago, "The fool hath said in his heart, there is no God." Thank you.